I want to remind you that on test days you have a little bit extra time if you want to show up early. I'll probably be here at 10 after to start. But that also means remember that whenever you come in quietly because people will already be working. Just don't forget to sign in and get the test from me. Now we can finish up the unit. We're looking at slide 9, and we've covered glycolysis up to this point, and glycolysis ends with pyruvate, right? Specifically, two molecules of pyruvate for every glucose that entered glycolysis. And the end of glycolysis represents a fork in the road. That's what's being represented here. It's a metabolic fork in the road because there's two possibilities. You have to deal with, there's two possible fates for the pyruvate, metabolically speaking. One of which is to send it to cellular respiration. And I say send it not only because it's a different process, but actually it's a different compartment in the cell in which cellular respiration occurs. Where has glycolysis occurred already? In the cytosol. Right. Glycolysis occurs in the cytosol. But cellular respiration occurs where? In the mitochondrion. Assuming that we're talking about a eukaryote, there are aerobic respiring prokaryotes as well, in which case there's no mitochondrion. But for a eukaryote, yes, cellular respiration occurs in the mitochondrion. So that's where pyruvate is going to be sent if that's the path that's taken. Now, our version of cellular respiration and most respiring organisms' version of cellular respiration is specifically aerobic respiration, which means that it requires oxygen, right? That's not the only kind of respiration, but a respiration mechanism, like I said last time, involves a pumping of protons, and this is where the big payoff comes in terms of making a lot more ATP. So we're able to make a lot more ATP from the fuel that's left from what was originally glucose. At this point, the fuel that's left is pyruvate. Pyruvate still has most of the usable energy in it that was there as glucose. Only a little bit has been put into the form of ATP. Some of it, remember, some of that energy is now being stored in the form of reduced coenzyme, NADH, also produced in glycolysis, right? And that can make a little bit more ATP for us as well. But the fuel itself, what's left of the carbon skeleton, pyruvate, well, the two pyruvates at this point, actually still has a lot of energy in it. So pyruvate is useful fuel if you continue to oxidize it. That's what cellular respiration is all about. It completes the oxidation of the fuel. Well, to do that, you have to strip off a bunch more electrons, right? That's what oxidation is. And those electrons need to be sent somewhere. Therefore, in any kind of cellular respiration mechanism, whether it's aerobic or anaerobic respiration, there needs to be something ultimately to receive those electrons. There needs to be a final electron acceptor. That's what oxygen does for us as aerobic respirers. There are other species that have anaerobic respiration that works the same way. It's just that it's something other than oxygen that receives the electrons ultimately from the fuel. Okay? Importantly, fermentation, which is the other path in the fork, is not anaerobic respiration. It's an anaerobic process because it doesn't require oxygen. Glycolysis is also anaerobic because it doesn't require oxygen. Fermentation is not anaerobic respiration, not because it's not anaerobic. It is anaerobic. It's not anaerobic respiration because it's not respiration. Okay? So anaerobic respiration is a different version of respiration that other organisms use using something other than oxygen. That would be this top fork. And that makes that kind of cell a lot more ATP for the fuel that was originally glucose. So that's the big payoff. And so for us aerobes, or aerobic respirers, if oxygen is present, definitely we want to take this upper path. We want to send pyruvate to the mitochondrion to have a much bigger ATP payoff via aerobic respiration. If oxygen is not available, though, if it's not available to the cell, then what has to happen is fermentation. That's the other path besides respiration. All right? Now, cellular respiration we're going to treat in a different chapter after you get 100 on this next test. Fermentation we're going to talk about right now, though. And most books only mention two different kinds of fermentation. There are several different kinds of fermentation. It depends on the species. Many more than just two kinds. But there are two that we pay particular importance. I mean, we pay a particular attention to. One of which is because it's the kind of fermentation that our own cells perform. The other we pay attention to because we use it for our own purposes often. So it's important to us economically, industrially. Okay, so the two major kinds that books mention are lactate fermentation or lactic acid fermentation and ethanol fermentation or alcohol fermentation. Now, which one of these do we do? Lactic acid fermentation. And that's because that's the product that's produced, lactic acid or lactate, depending on the pH. Ethanol is produced by yeast, for instance, is an example of an alcohol fermenter. And that's why it's important to us, right? We make ethanol for various reasons, as fuel, as booze. It's important in bread making, brewing, wine making, distilling, whatever you need alcohol for. But that's not the only two types. The point here, though, is not how many types there are or what the difference is really about them, as to what it is that fermentation accomplishes. Now, recall from glycolysis that you have, in part of the energy payoff phase, the reduction of NAD plus into NADH, NH plus, right? That's useful to the cell because it stores energy. NADH is like a full taxi, right? It has a passenger. Well, that step in which NAD plus gets reduced to NADH requires NAD plus to be there to get reduced, to pick up those electrons that came from the fuel. If there isn't an empty taxi, in other words, that step does not happen. And therefore, glycolysis would shut down. It wouldn't get past that step. Well, there's only so many taxis in the fleet. You have a finite and actually fairly small number of NAD molecules, whether they're in NAD plus form or NADH form. You have only so many taxis, right? If the entire fleet has already picked up passengers, in other words, if they're all in the reduced form, NADH, then there aren't any NAD pluses available to pick up more electrons from fuel, and glycolysis would shut down, which would kill you. So fermentation is a way for reduced coenzymes, NADH molecules, to be reoxidized back into NAD+ by getting rid of their electron passengers so that they can go back and pick up more new electrons from fuel in glycolysis, allowing glycolysis to continue, keeping the cell alive. Does that make sense? Now, that fermentation process in itself doesn't produce any ATP for you. And that's not what's trying to be accomplished. What's trying to be accomplished is the reoxidation of the coenzyme. Because without that, glycolysis will shut down. It's glycolysis that produces the ATP. Fermentation just allows glycolysis to continue. On the other hand, if you have oxygen available and you therefore are conducting the sets of reactions that we collectively call cellular respiration, then NADHs that have picked up electrons from the fuel have a place to dump those electrons. The electron transport chain, which is part of cellular respiration that we'll talk about more specifically later, that's where these taxis will dump their electrons if oxygen is available. They dump them into cellular respiration, or part of it. So cellular respiration accomplishes the reoxidation of the coenzyme, and therefore glycolysis continues to happen. Without the oxygen, though, to receive those electrons, they can no longer dump into cellular respiration. So you need another way for that to happen. So what happens in fermentation, regardless of what type, is that the output of glycolysis, which is pyruvate, either directly or something it gets turned into, gets reduced instead of being further oxidized. And the reason it gets reduced is so that the other thing that gets oxidized is NADH, which is what it's trying to accomplish. So for us, it's a direct process. We take pyruvate, which is useful fuel that we would normally want to continue oxidizing in the cellular respiration route. Instead, we reduce it. And what reduces it is NADH. By dumping its electrons that it received earlier from fuel in the glycolysis, dumps it back to pyruvate, that turns it into lactic acid or lactate. Okay, it's not because you want lactate, it's because you want NAD+. For a yeast or another alcohol fermenter, it's a two-step process. So pyruvate is first converted into acetaldehyde by decarboxylating it, taking one of the carbons off the chain along with two oxygens. That produces CO2. So it's not just alcohol that's produced, it's CO2 as well. That acetaldehyde then, it gets reduced by NADH. That accomplishes the reoxidation of the coenzyme, and that leaves you with ethanol. So this is why in brewing, you don't just have alcoholic beer, you have alcoholic carbonated beer. CO2 and alcohol are both produced. Okay. That's the purpose of fermentation. Now let's revisit glycolysis a little bit in slide 10. The shaded part here represents at least the beginning of glycolysis. The whole thing isn't shown, but up to the first six steps are shown. The point of the slide is not to look at glycolysis again, but notice that it's a central metabolic pathway that doesn't exist in isolation. A lot of other things, a lot of other pathways connect directly to it at different points. So we talked about glycolysis in terms of using glucose as the original fuel, which it often is, but it's not the only fuel. It's not even the only carbohydrate fuel, right? So there are other kinds of carbohydrates that you can use, including other monosaccharides. Well, the most prevalent monosaccharides, there's many, but ones that we typically have from our food are monoandisaccharides. Lactose, maltose, sucrose. Mannose is another monosaccharide, but lactose, maltose, and sucrose are disaccharides. Sucrose is just table sugar, for instance. So these are things that you get in your diet all the time. Well, disaccharides just need to be broken down into their constituent monosaccharides. In the case of lactose, that's galactose and glucose. Well, glucose goes right into glycolysis, of course. Galactose just needs to be isomerized. Galactose is another hexose. So you just need to switch around the arrangement of the atoms to make it into glucose, which can feed then into glycolysis. If you have maltose, that's really just two glucoses stuck together. So you break them apart, you have glucose, feeds directly into glycolysis. You have sucrose, it's a glucose and a fructose. They can both directly go into glycolysis, but at different points, right? Because part of glycolysis involves conversion of glucose into fructose. So that's what all these arrows represent. Mannose just needs to be isomerized. It's another hexose. So you just use a pathway to convert it into fructose and feed it into glycolysis. And there are others as well, not shown here. On the left, you have glycogen or starch. Depending on whether you're an animal or plant or bacterium, you make different kinds of storage polysaccharides. Different species do, right? Which one do we make? Glycogen. And these are storage polysaccharides that we've created for the purpose of storing that glucose they're made out of, but storing it in an insoluble way so that it doesn't interfere with osmotic balance. Now, if it's time to use that glucose that's locked up in the glycogen, it's just a matter of breaking it apart into individual glucoses, which now feed into the glycolytic pathway or glycolysis. And then what about if we're burning a fat? A fat is a good... Well, we don't burn fat. I shouldn't say it that way. If we use fat as an energy source, because that's one of its major functions is to store energy, we digest that fat into its parts. There's four parts, right? A glycerol and three fatty acids. Well, it's the glycerol and the three fatty acids individually that we can then burn as fuel. The fatty acids are dealt with in the mitochondrion as fuel. That's not shown here. But the glycerol is itself valuable fuel. The glycerol just needs to be isomerized into another triose. Glycerol is a three-carbon compound, right? So you isomerize that into one of the trioses at the fork in the road of glycolysis, and it feeds directly in and is used as fuel. So it's a very versatile central pathway glycolysis is, because it can deal with just about any fuel that we break down to use for energy. Let's go to 11. If we're using a storage polysaccharide, which in us would be glycogen, then that means we need to break it down into the individual glucoses. That's what's being shown here. For us, since glycogen is our storage polysaccharide, that process gets its own name. What would that be called? The breakdown of glycogen. Glycogenolysis. Right. Glycogenolysis is lysis of glycogen, or splitting of glycogen. So we have part of a glycogen molecule shown in the top. This is three glucose residues, but there's many more. That's why it has an ellipsis at the end. This breakdown, this lysis, is not, though, in this case, hydrolysis. Normally, you would use hydrolysis to break apart the monomers, right? And that involves water. This is an alternative lytic pathway called phosphorolysis. Using, instead of water, inorganic phosphate. And what this does, it works basically the same way. You know, you still give something an H and something an OH, but using phosphate instead of water. What this yields is the rest of the glycogen, however many glucoses there were originally, minus one, plus the one glucose that you're picking off gets the phosphate. So this is a useful glucose for fuel, but notice it's already phosphorylated. So you can skip that first step of glycolysis, which is to phosphorylate glucose into glucose 6-phosphate, right? This is glucose 1-phosphate, so the phosphate's in the wrong position, but it's still an activated monomer. It already has a phosphate on it, which means you can skip the step of using ATP to put phosphate onto it. Now, that's not free energy, though. I mean, it's not energy for nothing, because it took ATP to build the glycolysis to begin with. You're just getting that energy back. But anyway, it's in the wrong position, no big deal. You just use an enzyme to put it into a different position to make it into glucose 6-phosphate. Same thing happens with starch. It's just going to be a different enzyme. Notice the enzyme was listed here. It's either starch phosphorylase or glycogen phosphorylase. In us, it would be glycogen phosphorylase. That's the enzyme responsible for this phosphorolysis, which is the breakdown of glycogen via glycogenolysis. Okay, now to 12. The left side of this pathway, with the downward facing arrows, is glycolysis, as you see labeled here. And glycolysis, as we've already talked about, starts with glucose, ends with pyruvate. The reverse of that overall pathway is what's shown on the right with upward arrows, meaning starting with pyruvate and creating glucose. That reverse overall process is called gluconeogenesis. Right? Which literally means creation of new glucose, which is different from glycogenolysis, right? Glycogenolysis produces glucose, but it was already glucose to begin with. You just packed it all together. You're just unpacking it. Gluconeogenesis makes glucose out of something that wasn't glucose to begin with. And the slide indicates that these two things as entire pathways are effectively the reverse of each other. Effectively meaning if you pay attention to the start and end points, they reverse each other. But importantly, they are not just the same pathway run in reverse. At least not entirely. Let me go back just for a second to the slide 8. Notice, which is all the glycolytic steps. Notice that every one of these is a reaction, and most of these reactions are double arrowed, showing that they are very reversible reactions, highly reversible, except 3. The first step, Gly1, the third one, Gly3, the 10th one, Gly10. They're all written just in one direction. And that's because those are, for energy reasons, those are essentially irreversible. So they only run in the one direction. And that's why it wouldn't be a simple thing to just reverse them if you wanted to do gluconeogenesis instead of glycolysis. Well, these are the 3 green-shaded steps on the left of this. Gly1, Gly3, Gly10. And so those 3 enzymes that catalyze those reactions are important control points. This is a general biochemical theme. When you have irreversible reactions as part of a pathway, where the rest of them, or many of the others, are mostly reversible, it's the irreversible ones that serve as major control points. And how do you control reactions? By controlling the enzymes that catalyze those reactions, right? And what kind of control is most exquisite that you can enact on an enzyme? What kind of control really gives you? What is it? No, I'm talking about controlling an enzyme, either turning it on or turning it off. Allosteric regulation, yes, good. So at these irreversible reactions, which are major control points in biochemical pathways, that's where you find allosteric enzymes operating. So that their shape can be changed to one form or another, turning them either on or off, or turning them up or down, by binding them to an allosteric effector, either inhibitor or an activator. Okay, that's what's true of glycolysis at these three points. Those three enzymes are allosterically controlled. Well, the freely reversible ones, which are all the other glycolytic steps, actually in gluconeogenesis, those are exactly the reverse. So those enzymes can be used in either direction. And at those steps, except the three steps that I just talked about, these other glycolytic steps can be just reversed using the same enzyme for the corresponding step in gluconeogenesis. But the three irreversible steps in glycolysis need to be replaced by bypass reactions in the reverse direction using their own enzymes that will work irreversibly in the reverse direction. That's what happens in gluconeogenesis. But notice that the three irreversible glycolytic ones are replaced by four irreversible steps in gluconeogenesis. Gly-10 is replaced by two different steps in gluconeogenesis. Okay, so PC and PEP-CK, those undo or reverse the action of Gly-10, which is pyruvate kinase. Okay, so this is important because you would never want to undertake glycolysis and gluconeogenesis at the same time. That would be a total waste of energy, right? Because they undo each other. You want to do one or the other, depending on what the needs of the cell are. When you need energy, you better be running glycolysis to make the ATP, right? When you have more fuel than you need and you don't need to make any more ATP, you want to run the reverse, gluconeogenesis, which will take that extra fuel that you want to save for later. I'm sorry. When you want to make glucose as a fuel, because you have a buildup of what glycolysis spits out, which is pyruvate, then you run gluconeogenesis. And what's the principal place in your body, not the only place in your body where gluconeogenesis takes place, but what is the major site? Where in your own body is the major site for gluconeogenesis? Liver, good. Not the only place, but it's in terms of amount per gram, it would be the liver is the major place, one of its major functions. It's also, by the way, where a lot of glycogenolysis takes place in the liver, as well as glycogenesis. Glycogenesis is a word that refers to the production of glycogen, which is different from gluconeogenesis, right? The liver does a lot of things for you, which is why it's so important. Okay, let's go to 13 now and look at this in a little closer. So this is really the same thing as the previous slide, except the reactions that are just reversed aren't shown here in detail. We're focusing on the major control points, the irreversible reactions in each step, in each pathway. So remember I was talking about the three that were in glycolytic pathway? We already talked about Gly-1 and Gly-3 in the last lecture. Hexokinase, the one where that puts a phosphate onto glucose right when it comes in, right? Phosphofructokinase, that's the one that puts another phosphate onto what already has one phosphate, and that's why it makes it into fructose bisphosphate. Those are the irreversible ones. Those are the control reactions in glycolysis. Pyruvate kinase is actually named for its reverse even though it's not, even though I just told you that it's highly irreversible, so it was kind of silly to name it that, to tell you the truth. But that's why the name makes sense. A kinase is what, in general? What does it do? Something that phosphorylates something else. Well, if you run this in reverse, you take pyruvate and put phosphate onto it, what you have is phosphoenyl pyruvate. Right? That's why it got its name, even though it runs in this direction. So don't be confused by that. But anyway, those are the three major control points. On gluconeogenesis, you have pyruvate carboxylase and fructose 1,6 bisphosphatase. Those are, even though there's four irreversible ones, these are the major control points for gluconeogenesis. And the main point of this slide is that the allosteric effectors, which are the particles that can bind reversibly to the allosteric sites on these major control enzymes to turn them either up or down in their activity, turn them on or off, those work in opposite ways in the two different pathways. These pathways have a reciprocal relationship, right? They undo each other. You don't want to have them both on or off at the same time. You want one or the other. So it should make sense to you logically that an allosteric effector that turns a glycolytic enzyme on should, if it affects a gluconeogenic enzyme at all, it should do the opposite, right? It should turn it off. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm getting to right now. But does that make sense? If you're going to turn on one pathway, you should simultaneously turn the other pathway off. And so that's why these metabolites that you see listed to the left, or left and right, these have opposite effects on the two different pathways. Green means that it's stimulatory. So it would be an allosteric activator in that case for that type of enzyme. Well, notice ATP, for instance. If ATP is already in high supply, in other words, if it's building up, ATP, it should make sense to you, should shut down glycolysis. That's why it has a negative by it. ATP will act as an allosteric inhibitor of phosphofructokinase and therefore shut down the glycolytic pathway. But because of the reciprocity of these two pathways, ATP... I should have talked about AMP coming from the fact that ATP is in short supply, right? If ATP is not building up, the cell is using it. If the cell is using ATP to form ADP and then using ADP to put it into AMP, that's a strong signal to the cell that you don't have very much energy, right? So AMP is going to shut down gluconeogenesis because what you really need to be doing at that point is concentrating on burning fuel, not producing fuel. Right? Now, on fructose 1,6 bisphosphate, which is what this is, that simply refers to the fact that fructose 1,6 bisphosphate is an intermediate in the glycolysis pathway. So if it builds up at this point, what it means is that the reactions downstream of it are not using it up. So notice what it does is tell the enzyme downstream, pyruvate kinase, hurry up, basically. Start allowing the rest of glycolysis to proceed so that we can use the built-up fructose 1,6 bisphosphate. Acetyl-CoA and citrate, those are intermediates in the citric acid cycle, which is part of cellular respiration. So if those start building up, in other words, they're not being used by cellular respiration, that's a signal that you're already conducting enough cellular respiration. You have enough energy at the time. So these feed back and turn down glycolysis. Why would you send cellular respiration more pyruvate if you already are starting to build up the stuff that cellular respiration produces in the citric acid cycle? That's the logic behind this. All right, but acetyl-CoA has exactly the opposite effect on the glycolytic pathway as it does on the gluconeogenic pathway. Acetyl-CoA stimulates pyruvate carboxylase and therefore turns on gluconeogenesis at the same time that it turns off glycolysis. So they're never on at the same time for good reason. Does that make sense, at least logically? The thing that we haven't mentioned here is F26BP, which is fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, which is not part of these pathways, but obviously it's similar to glucose 1,6-bisphosphate. It just has a phosphate in a different position. We're going to talk about that in the next slide because that is an important way to control these two pathways reciprocally. So let's go to 14 and talk about fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Now, fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is fuel, right? It's not an enzyme. But there's an enzyme named after it because it's a substrate for that enzyme. And that enzyme is called fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase. That's the one on the right here. Well, that's actually the same enzyme as PFK2, which is phosphofructokinase 2. When I mentioned phosphofructokinase, which is a major control enzyme of glycolysis, that really is phosphofructokinase 1, which is its own enzyme. Okay? This is phosphofructokinase 2. But that same protein complex that acts as phosphofructokinase 2 is also fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase. It's just in a different conformation. So this is an example of what we call a bifunctional enzyme. It's different from just turning one enzyme off and therefore it's no longer doing its job. Here we're changing the shape of an enzyme and causing it to be a different kind of enzyme. Okay, so it's two enzymes in one, really, with different active sites for different substrates. And not only is it two enzymes in one, but one of those enzyme activities is the opposite of the other one. So instead of just being on or off, it's on in one direction or on in the other direction. Okay, does that make sense? So these two blue things shown here, that's really the same enzyme complex, but in two different conformations doing two different jobs. Now remember that a kinase is an enzyme that adds a phosphate to something. What is the opposite of a kinase? A phosphatase. A phosphatase removes a phosphate. And that's what this same enzyme, the same bifunctional enzyme, is. It's both a kinase and a phosphatase, but never both at once. It's one or the other. And the way that it changes between being a kinase or having kinase activity, which is the left, to having phosphatase activity, which is on the right, is by being itself either phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. So this is why there is another pair of enzymes, a kinase and a phosphatase, which are responsible for either phosphorylating or dephosphorylating this bifunctional enzyme, PFK2. All right, you following that all? If the kinase, which gets activated when in response to glucagon or epinephrine, stress hormones, these These will activate the kinase that's responsible for phosphorylating phosphofructokinase 2. Well, when it gets phosphorylated, then that puts it into the fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase configuration. So in the phosphorylated version of this, it is not a kinase. It's acting as a phosphatase. Okay? A kinase put it into that configuration, though. On the other hand, in the absence of this signal, glucagon or epinephrine, then instead a different phosphatase is going to remove the phosphate from the bifunctional enzyme. And that's going to switch it from being fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase into phosphofructokinase 2. All right? Now let's consider what each of these two configurations accomplishes. Let's go on the left first. Let's assume that let's assume that PFK2 is the configuration. All right? So the phosphatase has already operated here. It's removed the phosphate. That's why we're in the unphosphorylated version of the bifunctional enzyme. That would occur in the absence of glucagon or epinephrine. Clear? The reason I said that that fructose 2,6-bisphosphate is a major controller of the two reciprocal pathways is because of what PFK2 does. Phosphofructokinase 2 will allow for the phosphorylation of fructose 6-phosphate to make it into fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Okay? In other words, the PFK2 is the enzyme that will allow ATP to deliver one of its phosphates to fructose 6-phosphate to make it into fructose 2,6-bisphosphate. Which itself now is the most important allosteric regulator of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. That's what's happening right here. If you have glucose 2,6-bisphosphate, then it acts as an allosteric activator, the plus sign, of phosphofructokinase 1, which is a glycolytic enzyme, right? The most important control enzyme in glycolysis. So that will activate glycolysis. Is that all clear? Well, it's just the opposite if you have glucagon or epinephrine present. That's going to switch the phosphorylation status of the bifunctional enzyme. It's going to turn it into fructose 2,6-bisphosphatase instead. And when it's in this configuration, then its job is to dephosphorylate fructose 2,6-bisphosphate, turning it into fructose 6-phosphate. All right? Well, that's going to cause an inhibitory effect on fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, and that's going to shut down gluconeogenesis. Okay? Does that all make sense? There's a lot of terminology in there that's very similar because there's multiple kinases, there's multiple phosphatases, but no matter what their names are, kinases are always things that are going to phosphorylate other things. Phosphatases are always dephosphorylating. And because of the reciprocal nature of glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, you want to turn one on but not the other, right, at the same time. It would be a waste to just go through a cycle to undo yourself right away. Depends on the needs of the cell as to which one is turned on. That's the major point. But the reason that this ties into the previous slide is because of F26BP shown on slide 13. Notice that it will shut down gluconeogenesis or it will activate glycolysis. That's a reciprocal control. All right? But the presence or absence of fructose 2,6-bisphosphate itself depends on the enzymatic status of the bifunctional enzyme that we were talking about. That's why it all ties together, these last two slides. So now you should be ready for Friday. Just remember to bring an answer form.